The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make the show possible and to check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. My guest this week is Hamish Steele, whose graphic novel Deadendia is being adapted into an animated series at Netflix. The show will feature a gay trans man as the lead character, and it's inspired both by Hamish's friends and his love of shows like Doctor Who and movies like The Addams Family Values, which feature queer-ish, if not explicitly queer, ensembles. Hamish is also running a Kickstarter right now for a comic book called Croc and Roll that promises to be Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles meets Gem and the Holograms meets Scott Pilgrim meets Big Gay Alligator Tears. I'm super excited to chat with him about his inspirations and his controversial opinions about the difference between films with queer people in them versus films that queer people actually like. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook, where I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode. This week, you can look forward to video clips from The Addams Family, Doctor Who, and from Hamish's own animation projects. And speaking of videos, check out my YouTube series Culture Cruise, where I do a deep dive into LGBTQ milestones and entertainment that changed the world. Last month's video was all about the documentary Paris is Burning, and you can find that by searching YouTube for Culture Cruise. And I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly live stream on August 1st at 11 a.m. Pacific. It's a nice, relaxing time to just hang out and chat. There's a link at the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Also, if you're looking for more queer podcasts, check out my narrative comedy shows Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends for an escape into a world of fantasy with drag queens playing Dungeons and Dragons. You can subscribe to both shows at queensofadventure.com or search your favorite podcast app. Now, here's Hamish. Well, this week I'm speaking with graphic novelist and animation showrunner Hamish Steele. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you. It's a genuine honor. We had you on, I did a podcast a long time ago, and we had you on as a one and only live episode guest.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize it was like I was the one guest.
We've had guests, but we never did a live episode since or before. And now I don't do the podcast anymore.
Well, I'm glad I got in. That was at the was that the thing that we recorded at the con?
Yeah, that was Worlds a few years ago.
Yeah, 2017, I think. Kind of a nerd fantasy sci-fi convention in just outside London.
Yes, and I don't think even that con is on.
We live in a changing world. Mm-hmm. So I'm so delighted to have you on today because not only am I a huge fan of your work, but you have some very exciting stuff in the pipeline right now. So let's get right to it with what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Well, I want to say something cooler, but I think it's Doctor Who.
Great. There's no need to, this show has never been cool. So let's go with that. Tell me about Doctor Who and what it's like to experience that show as, a British person, because, in the US it's seen as something of it's sort of exotic and classy because it's British.
Wow. actually, that's true. I've listened to quite a few Doctor Who podcasts in my time and almost all of them are American. And so I'm not exposed to too much British fandom. Yeah, so the reason why I said I wanted to pick something cooler is that I think I was quite lucky in that I watched a lot of, seminal, life-changing queer cinema and stuff quite early on. Mm-hmm. I don't remember a time when, Rocky Horror Picture Show wasn't being played in our house. I grew up with a lot of that stuff, and I think I either watched sort of iconic queer movies either too young or too late for them to really impact me. Mm. But Doctor Who, for those that don't know, it started in the 60s, it ran to 1989, and then it went off the air, and I was born in 1990. I grew up what the fandom calls the wilderness years. I do remember a VHS of a serial we watched quite a bit, and there was a TV movie, and there was some stuff, but it got rebooted in 2005 by Russell T. Davies, who is the creator of Queer as Folk, the UK original. He's done a lot of other stuff since that's also had sort of prominent queer stuff. And when it came back in 2005, I honestly want to say that genre television in general was kind of dying. And especially in the UK, there was just nothing sci-fi or fantasy of any sort. I genuinely think stuff like I'm loath to mention this, but stuff like Harry Potter's popularity and things like that, and maybe even Buffy and some things that we were getting imported, I think convinced the BBC to like revisit it. And when it got rebooted, it was incredibly pared back. They kind of got rid of all the sort of continuity and lore, but didn't make it a reboot. They made it a continuation, but kept it very much the basics. And I was 14, I think. And so I think at 14, I was the exact right age to not just love it, but also be very fascinated by its production. And I definitely felt a kind of, I was so into sort of fantasy and sci-fi stuff that I could like finally see a show made in the UK that I kind of wanted to be involved in. And one of the things I think that's so important about it, I mentioned Russell T Davies, but one thing that Doctor Who's always done, pretty much, is that the writer of the individual episode, their name is in the credits the same size as the lead actors. It's not like, you know, it sort of fades on screen at the bottom during the first scene or anything. It's always like the Doctor actor, the companion actor, the name of the episode, and who wrote it. And I think that was probably the first time I was like really thinking about a writer wrote this episode. And because the format of the show is quite free reign, you could really like start to tell different writers' tastes and like what kind of episodes they would do and what kind of, you know, how they wrote characters. And so I became very aware of what a TV writer did.
How queer was it? You mentioned that it was Russell T Davies who did Queer as Folk. So, like, did you feel anything kind of gay about the show?
Yes. So, in the UK Queer as Folk, I've never seen the US one, actually. And to be honest, as a closeted kid, when I first saw stuff about the UK Queer as Folk, I kind of was afraid of it. I wasn't drawn to it, and I don't blame the show at all, but I was at an age where I kind of wanted to be everything that the characters in the show were not. I think I went through a sort of not like those gays phase, but I was just very closeted and very scared of like something like Brokeback Mountain would like do good. It also came with having to survive through an era of people making jokes about it. So something like Queer as Folk obviously meant a lot to maybe people slightly older than me. But as a kid in the playground, it was just like the thing people were making fun of. And like, oh my God, did you see that gay thing last night? So I don't know why I'm even saying this, but Russell T Davies, Doctor Who fans call him RTD. He was breaking boundaries, and being a fan of Doctor Who was a little bit like the UK version of A Friend of Dorothy.
Oh, really?
Doctor Who has an incredibly gay fan base. And I think during the kind of 90s, the Will Smith years where I was off TV, there was a lot of like Doctor Who fan societies made up predominantly of gay men. I mean, the showrunner during the 80s was also gay. The first director of the first ever episode in the 60s was gay. There's a lot of gayness behind the scenes. And so it had this kind of cult following. I think it's also just like very campy. It featured, as much as it's about the Doctor, the sort of companion role is usually women. And so there's lots of these kind of powerful 80s female role models. And there's just a lot of like campiness about it. So it definitely had that kind of vibe. And when it came back, it's so strange to think of modern shows kind of struggling to have queer representation, because it did it so effortlessly, but also just so... Essentially, one of the main characters in the very first season of the reboot is Captain Jack Harkness, who was a kind of future bisexual, omnisexual. It's very vague on... He's, like, from the future, so sexuality doesn't matter. And he's, like, flirting with everyone. He kisses the Doctor and companion. And he's also kind of, like, the coolest character in the show. And it's done with kind of zero... I want to say preachiness, but you know, I would never like refer to any queer representation of preachiness, but like it just does it. Whereas I think a modern show would try and like pat itself on the back for doing it. And even in incidental episodes, like there's just queer relationships and gay people. And it was the first time I think of seeing myself in a kind of fantasy setting. It's just so interesting to me that like Star Trek only just did it. I know obviously there was lots of queer allegories and things like that in earlier seasons, but like they only really just got over that line, and Star Wars arguably still hasn't. Every time I say there's no gay characters in Star Wars, I always hear about some extended universe mention of someone's dead lover or something. But it's funny to me that like in 2005, Doctor Who was just kind of doing it without controversy.
When you were watching it, was that like meaningful to you? Like, I know you said with Queer as Folk, it was something that people made fun of, and you might have felt like you wanted to distance yourself from it. But was it more comfortable with Doctor Who?
I think looking back, it was. At the time, maybe not so. Like I said, it's a family show, so I would watch it a lot with my brothers. And maybe if this character in particular was kissing men and things like that, there might be a little kind of chuckle or something. But the thing is, the show, like I said, this kind of campy, well, yeah, what, like, deal with it kind of vibe meant that if you were laughing at it, it was kind of laughing at itself as well. It never took itself too seriously. Like, the same episode that this, like, male companion kisses the male doctor character, and it's not treated as a joke, it's treated as a very sincere moment of, like, sort of, I don't know. In that same episode, there's like a robot Anne Robinson chasing Pepper Pot aliens around a spaceship. Like, it's never taken itself too seriously. I've never really thought of it as sci-fi. It's kind of like a sci-fi flavored adventure series.
It's pulpy.
Yeah, it's very pulpy. So I think the thing with Queer as Folk is that at the time, I just didn't want anyone to think I was like that. Nowadays I'm totally cool with it, but I just think when there's not much queer representation, whatever you do get has to explain far more. I don't even know what I'm trying to say, but like I did feel, and that character in particular in Doctor Who was very much a kind of like kicking the barn doors open, saying, hi, I'm here, I'm queer, get used to it. But as the show went on, there was much more subtler stuff, much more nuanced things, and also bad. Like, but I think what Doctor Who has over a lot of other shows is that it has multiple queer characters, and some of them people like, some of them people don't. Some are kind of villains, some are incidental, some are main characters. Arguably the Doctor is gender fluid. So I felt it's a safe space. And I think that's why I was so encouraged by seeing the writers and wanting to be part of that world, because I knew that the people making it weren't doing it for brownie points or doing it for kudos. They were doing it because they were representing themselves and writing the content they wanted to see.
Was that something that you were doing? Like, I know you for your comics and your writing now, and I'm curious, like, when that started for you. Like, when did you start thinking of yourself as a creator?
This is going to sound really very pretentious, but I have always saw myself as a storyteller. And genuinely, like in the playground, I would kind of be a dungeon master to my friends, and we would like play games, but I would be in charge of like the plot and making sure that there was a coherent theme to the story today. And I would like play all the NPCs while they like adventured around. It was kind of, I don't know, I did that a lot.
Sure, you're a showrunner even then.
Yeah, basically. I just love telling stories. I always think that the reason I went into comics is because it was kind of the easiest, cheapest way for me to get the stories in my head in front of people's eyes. You don't necessarily, for a comic, need a budget or a film crew or anything like that. I think, obviously, having budget and getting paid and everything is very vital eventually, but I could just start drawing comics, you know, in my room with a pad of paper.
So what would you draw?
I started off doing like gag comics. I kept like designing little characters in the, like the margins of my schoolwork, and then I would say, oh, this is going to be the next big thing. This is going to be in every newspaper across the country. And I'd draw a few and then realize that actually I'm not very good at coming up with funny jokes. I would say arguably a lot of gag comic people don't possess that mastery. It's a very hard thing to do, to make a weekly comic hilarious each time. But, you know, they'd make my friends laugh. And then I'll say, like, the reason why Doctor Who affected me so much, there's a lot of things. I met my husband through a Doctor Who forum. I met my best friend through Doctor Who, like, fan art on DeviantArt. That's why, like, you know, I love a lot of other media, but when I think about Doctor Who, it's the thing that my life would be the most different had I not watched it, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And when Doctor Who came out, that's when I did start thinking about in, like, showrunner terms, and suddenly my comics started becoming, they started having like season arcs, and they started blowing out proportion. And I remember I would literally tell people when I was like 15 or 16, oh yeah, I'm like directing a whole animated series, and it's going to be like 20 episodes, they're all going to be an hour long, it's going to come out next year. And I was working on these things, but I was just like, I didn't have the kind of reality goggles on to realize that a TV show is made by hundreds of people and takes millions of pounds to make. I was just like, well, if you want to do it enough, then you can do it. So I have all these like scripts and like storyboards and character turnarounds and all this kind of stuff from when I was like 15, because I was like show running stuff in my head. I mentioned my best friend. It's called Lydia Butts. She's a comic artist as well. And we, for like 5 years, worked on a Doctor Who fan comic, which we ended up only making like an issue and a half of. And it's that, like, I love fan projects, so I'm not going to, you know, besmirch them too much. But there was this kind of realization of like, we have been working on this thing for 5 years, but neither of us have the rights to actually like publish or make anything from. I think the world's actually changed quite a lot, and I know a lot of people get jobs through fan art, but Doctor Who was like very, very inspiring to us creatively, but also maybe somewhat destructive. We could have been making other comics, but...
Did you put gay stuff into the work that you were creating then?
I would say probably not until I came out. I came out when I was 19. I think until then there might have been probably... I think about like the Wachowskis making The Matrix, where it's like doesn't have any trans themes, and then they come out and oh my god, this is the most trans movie I've ever seen. So it's like I wouldn't say there was like explicit representation, but I was making like Barbarella-esque like campy space opera stuff. I was making I was writing like really outrageous musicals. Like, one of the films I would have mentioned as just inspiring to me would be Adam's Family Values, which just was watched on loop in our house. I don't know what I would be without Debbie Jelinski. And it's that kind of stuff.
Can you describe that for, like, folks who aren't familiar? Can you describe what that movie is and what she is in particular?
Adam's Family 1 is great. It's fine. It's a good adaptation of the source material. The sequel, Adam's Family Values, is... okay, people might be mad at me for saying this, but sometimes when people recommend me quote-unquote gay films or content, I say, is it actually gay, like Adam's Family Values, or is it fake gay, like Call Me By Your Name?
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by this...
Lots to unpack there.
...is... So I have a film club as well. I have like a queer little film gathering group. And we started off watching films with queer people in them. And then we started watching films that queer people like. And the Venn diagram of that has no overlap. Almost no overlap, I'd say.
Hmm.
I feel like so many films with queer characters in them are not made for queer people. If they are made for queer people by queer people, they are often incredibly good and also incredibly not suitable for like a fun film night. They're often very truthful, beautiful, but like the kinds of like, let's watch a fun movie that's gay, it's very hard to find that. And so to me, something like Addams Family Values is queer cinema because its ripple effect, I feel, is much greater towards a larger amount of like queer creative people, maybe, than seeing two kind of straight actors like pretend to kiss each other and enjoy it. I'm sorry, I'm being very shady right now. But Addams Family Values is such an oddly constructed film as well. It's written like a Simpsons episode in that there's like a plot change, then a series of vignettes exploring that plot change, then another plot change happens, and then a series of vignettes. Like, it's not got a normal film structure. And like, arguably, Debbie is like the protagonist in a way. She is the character who starts the film with wants and needs, and like, she's the one that kind of goes on a hero's journey in a way. She's the villain, again, if people haven't seen this film. She is the villain. She's played by Joan Cusack. She is an opposite to the Addams in a visual sense. In a very basic term, she wears white, they wear black. She is blonde, they're all dark-haired. She's very bubbly and, like, loud and in charge, and they're all kind of subdued and subtle. But ultimately, she's, like, the perfect Addams, because she's also, like, supremely evil. Not that they are, but, like, she would fit in perfectly. And they all love her. But she can't... She says, doesn't she deserve love and jewelry? And she's got that love. Everyone loves her, but she's so caught up on not having, you know, the grass is always greener. I don't know. I love her a lot. She's amazing. I love characters like that. But like, she's not a gay person. She's not, there's no queer representation in that film. But it's just, it just makes me so happy. I don't know how to, I don't think I can, I don't have the intelligence to go any deeper than that. But I just see.
Well, I think you're describing like the queer sensibility that you saw in Doctor Who. Like, it's made by queer people, and it feels campy and pulpy, and there's kind of like a gleeful stupidness to it, even without there being like, you know, man on man action.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not saying no to Fester getting a husband in the next movie, like, and Wednesday is in no way straight, but...
That's a good point. Yeah, that is a very, like, little lesbian character.
I think there is... I love stuff that's both. I think Doctor Who is both. That's why I like it. And that's the kind of stuff I do want to make. I want to make stuff that doesn't have to sacrifice the sort of camp sensibilities and in order to get representation. I mean, I think I'm part of the problem. Like, I said earlier that I kind of responded badly to Queer as Folk as a closeted person, but then we got characters who, in some ways, I'd say are like straight-washed, where the progressive thing people thought to do was to make gay characters as straight as possible to show that we're just the same as everybody else, which is what I think I wanted as a teen, but now I get very mad that like, gay characters don't get to, you know, be the protagonist and be important and be heroes, but also have a lisp or also, you know, be a more gay character. Like, I kind of want that kind of middle ground or that blend where, you know, if they announced tomorrow that the next Star Trek captain was going to be a gay person, I would be very surprised if they also had quote unquote, major quote unquote, gay voice. I feel like what they'd be doing with that would be like, oh, you know, well, gay, being gay doesn't define him. You wouldn't even know he was gay, but I don't know. I'm going down a weird rabbit hole. But I think what I want to create is stuff that has that Addams Family Values like vibe, but also canonical queer characters can live in this world as well.
So yeah, let's talk about the stuff that you've created. Like, Dead India is getting a lot of attention these days, but like, what led up to that? Like, what are the things that you're proud of having made?
Well, obviously, so for those that don't know, my comic book Deadendia is getting a Netflix show. I am the showrunner of it. It's amazing. It's everything I dreamed and more. And also, showrunning your first show during a global pandemic is really hard. So it's very tough. It's lots of hard work. I'm very proud of it, though. It's the culmination of quite a long journey. My day-to-day job has been development. So I've been developing shows at developed shows at the BBC, at Nickelodeon, at Disney, pretty much anywhere that makes cartoons. I have had a pitch that I've developed there for like a year or so. And each time I've been pushing for queer representation in different ways. Earlier on, it would be a gentle, like, well, maybe in the third season we could, like, maybe hint at this character, maybe possibly looking at another character. Then it sometimes I would be holding back tears because they were telling me that they liked what I was making, but it was inappropriate for me to be in it. So there's been times when I've been making shows intended for kids, but they've made me feel like me wanting to put queer characters in that is like sex predatory, or like it's inappropriate in like a way that really dehumanizes you. And thanks to the general, like, I know that loads of other creators have been doing this, and so thanks to, you know, people like Rebecca Sugar and Noelle Stevenson and other like queer showrunners doing those battles as well, the conversation's changed massively, and in a good way. I'm not going to complain that Netflix are letting me like have queer characters, but there was a definite period of time early on making Deadendia that I was scared to even mention the queer stuff because I'd been hurt many times before. And I will say that there's like almost a kind of, when the industry changes that much so quickly without any kind of apology or acknowledgement that they were like this only like a year or two ago, it can be quite painful when they say like, oh, we love all the queer stuff. Like, why didn't you, you know, why hasn't this show kind of happened before? Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, you literally said we couldn't. I go off on these like sad, depressed tangents quite a lot. I'm sounding quite negative. But it's an adaptation of a comic that I made, and I made a webcomic. And I think in the webcomic world, it's one of the best places for queer creators getting to show their vision untarnished or they've never had to convince anyone to like allow the queer content. In webcomic world, people really do just make what they want to make, for good or ill. So the fact that the book's published already with these characters meant that I felt quite secure that I could, I guess, demand the representation I wanted, but Netflix have genuinely never questioned it and never thought that it wouldn't be there.
When you first started making the comic, like, what were your aspirations for it? Like, did you think like, all right, this is going to be a Netflix series, or did you like, were you thinking of it like as animated when you started drawing it?
Deadendia has gone on a weird road. It's so now it is a Netflix show, which is an adaptation of some graphic novels, which are an adaptation of a webcomic, which were an adaptation of a animated short from about 8 years ago I made called Dead End, which is still available on YouTube. And I made that with Frederator Studios, who make Adventure Time and things like that. And that short was an adaptation of a different comic featuring these characters. So it's gone on a very long, weird journey. And there's been times when I thought it would be an animated show, and there's been times when I was perfectly happy with it continuing just as a comic. So I've definitely always thought it could be a show, but I don't think we ever actually pitched it to Netflix. When I say that my day job was development, I always had like irons and five fires. And I say I was like developing something at Netflix and Disney and BBC. Often this was all at the same time. So we just had a meeting with Netflix and I pitched a number of shows, which weren't Deadendia, but it was then when I said, oh, and by the way, like, I do comics on the side, these are my books. There's also a YouTube short for this Deadendia book. And then things happened quite quickly. So I think them seeing a kind of complete vision in the form of a graphic novel was a really, was probably better than any like pitch could have been.
Mm-hmm. What was your, like, not to put you on the spot here, but like, what is your pitch for like when someone's like, what's it about?
It is set in a amusement park that is built on a portal to 13 demonic and angelic planes of existence. And it follows the kind of teens that work at the park, and they have to sort of survive the demonic invasions while also like just trying to keep their jobs in a theme park. I'd say it's very Buffy, very Gravity Falls, but I've always described it as like a comedy horror teen drama. So it has a lot of kind of relationship stuff. And I think the teen drama stuff might, it go, it, in my head, it goes quite hard. It goes quite serious sometimes. This is, I'm so bad at these like soundbitey, tiny little, and that's the show. That's the log line. I'd say that like, it's about a character called Barney as well. So on a more kind of like literal sense, it's about a character called Barney. He is a young trans teen who runs away from home and goes to live in this theme park. He brings his dog Pugsley, who seconds into like living in this park gets possessed by a ancient demonic king and continues the rest of the show as this magic talking dog. And then also the other sort of main character is Norma, who is on the spectrum and is obsessed with the park and like the history of it. And she's always wanted a job at this park. And when she discovers demons, is equally excited by learning everything about them. And then the fourth character, is Courtney, who kind of works as their boss. And she's a banished demon who now lives on Earth and wants to do everything she can to get back to her demon world.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask, when you started describing it, I was like, how queer are we talking? But it sounds like it'll just right off the bat, you want to make sure like there's a lot of diverse characters in there.
Yeah. I mean, when I was making it as a webcomic, it was genuinely just about my friends and I. Like, most of the characters were kind of based on friends. It was very much about...
In a haunted amusement park.
Yes, definitely. It's interesting then going to make like a, you know, big budget Netflix production, how much you then have to vet everything by. Like, we're working really closely with GLAAD. We have sort of consultants about sort of the autism storylines and things like that. Like, I just wrote about my experiences, and then I had to make sure with this much wider audience that we were getting everything right. And yeah, like, there's more queer representation than just Barney as well. I don't want to spoil too much, or I'm not even sure how much I'm allowed to say, but if you've read the books, there's lots more queer characters. I'm still kind of kick myself sometimes, but we're he's allowed to be in this show and be as like lovable and kind of, he is just the main character. I've always kind of described him as an everyman, and he is the kind of audience surrogate. And so being able to sort of convince, and I say convince, again, we didn't get any pushback, but like showing that an audience surrogate everyman type character can be like a gay trans teen who, it just means a lot, I think, to me. Yeah.
You said that the book was a lot of your friends, like you, or the webcomic was you writing about your friends. How much of you is in it?
I'd say a lot. A lot of it. I'm a little nervous to have this like on the record right now. I'm actually in the process of going to get diagnosed for whatever's up with my brain. When writing Norma, we got our kind of autism consultant in, and she read the scripts and said, wow, Hamish, you must have done so much research. And I was like, 29 years of it. So I'm not, It's weird. I mean, I don't expect everyone to relate to these characters. I think with Barney, while he's this sort of queer kid who doesn't feel like his family listened to him and he runs away, I'm not expecting everyone to relate to the specifics, but I think everyone can relate to having, to not feeling kind of invisible and having parents who don't sort of have your back sometimes. With Norma, like, I'm not expecting everyone to relate to her specifically for everything that she is, but we always try and ground the episodes in like a universal truth or a universal feeling that a, you know, teen might have.
Mm.
Even in episodes with like that focus on, you know, the talking dog or the demon, like our demon character gets quite depressed and feels really homesick and like, you know, doesn't feel like they can connect to anyone. Pugsley has this demon inside him, so he's always rattling, you know, where does the dog begin and where does the demon end? Like, mm-hmm. like we always try and make sure that there's something relatable to everyone. And so, yeah, there is a lot of me in it. It's not my great, like, autobiographic masterwork or anything, but Barney and Norma are definitely both sides of me.
You know, something you're describing there is, like, I think of everything you've described, the queerest thing is this idea of a chosen family and we're, you know, supporting each other and we're all strange in our own special ways, but we see the value in each other and support and all that stuff, especially when you may not have the support of a biological family. And I don't know, even though the Addams family are themselves, you know, they're all related by blood, there's something that feels very like queer family about them. And I think with Doctor Who as well, those are often people thrown together by circumstance, and yet still there's that queer sensibility of like, okay, we're in this together and we're sort of forming a family unit in spite of our just having met.
Definitely. I mean, the Doctor Who has had many different plot lines over the years, but a kind of thing that they go back to time and time again is the companion character often has a quite unfulfilled life or feels quite trapped, whether it be by family or where they're from or anything. And there's definitely some queer wish fulfillment when you're young at the idea of like someone coming out of space, thinking you're the most amazing person in the world and showing you the, you know, the big city lights of the universe. Found family is a massive theme in Deadendia. Like it pretty much gets said outright. And Barney, you know, I mean, one interesting difference that when writing the show is that as a comic book, it was very much Barney's point of view. He ran away from home. His family life isn't even that much of a focus because in a comic, I felt like someone would be reading this solo and on their own and they can relate to Barney and that's what's important. When making a show, I had to think that families might be watching this together and that parents might be watching it with their kids who might be going through a similar thing as Barney. And also, as a I think the books are aimed a little bit older, or at least the show has to accept that there might be any age watching it in the room. So we've tried to flesh out the family a bit more and show a little bit of their point of view and realize that with a much bigger audience that the show will hopefully have, it won't just be Barney's watching, it's going to be Barney's parents watching, if that makes any kind of sense. I don't know. We're just trying to be very careful, but at the same time, like I was saying earlier, like, we're not trying to tell the universal trans story. It literally is just Barney's story. And I'm really hoping that other shows with trans characters for kids can get through and tell more varied storylines as well.
What you're describing with starting with Barney's story and then making a little bit more about the family really reminds me of my experience watching, this is going to sound like a leap, but my experience watching, do you know this American series, My So-Called Life?
I don't know it, but I know my husband will have watched all of it.
Okay, so it's from the 90s. It's Claire Danes. And when I was watching it, I was like just at the same age as the teenager characters on that show. And I'm like, oh, this is so identifiable. And I'm this character. And I know what they're going through. And watching it now in my 30s, I'm like, ah, the parents. I get the parents. This annoying teenage kid that they have. So I wonder, like, to what extent, like, I know you're saying, like, you're thinking very much about your audience, but also, you know, you've been sitting with these characters and living with their story for so long. I wonder if you've sort of grown up as the story is growing up.
Yeah, definitely. I think also we have parents in our writer's room. We have people in our writer's room who always want to kind of vouch for them a little bit. I think there's just been a general kind of adjustment. And I think making a webcomic on Tumblr in like 2015 or whatever is a different, on your own as well, just writing it completely on your own and trying to get clicks. You do tell a slightly different story. And even going from the webcomic to the graphic novel and realizing that every page of this graphic novel is no longer going to like have my little blurb at the bottom and have people able to like click on my name and see everything or where I'm coming from. That also affected the story slightly. Like here's a like strange example. In the webcomic, just from the first page of me drawing Barney, I was having people quote unquote headcanon him as trans. Even though he canonically was, it just hadn't been mentioned yet. But just from his design and being on Tumblr, people were like, ah, it's me, that trans character. And I could be a bit more subtle. Like the first mention of him being trans is a few pages in, he kind of like offhand mentions his binder. But I noticed that a lot of cis readers weren't clocking that, or like didn't know what he meant by binder, or didn't even really acknowledge it. And so when he finally mentions he's trans, I noticed that some readers saw that as like a big twist reveal when it wasn't meant to be. And similarly, like in the webcomic, it's just sort of assumed that people would know he's trans and not care. But then I didn't really mention it. And he gets into this relationship with a guy called Logs. And some readers were just kind of panicked that Logs didn't know and like were waiting for the moment he found out and to like run away from Barney and be disgusted and all the stuff. And it never even crossed my mind that he wouldn't know. I don't know if I'm making any kind of sense, but basically from the webcomic to the book to the Netflix show, there's always been this extra level of like, this is going to reach an audience who might not be engaging with like queer theory on the same level you are. So on Tumblr in 2015, making a webcomic, like already I kind of knew I was preaching to the choir and I knew I could do a lot of shorthand and just like get on with it. When it came to the book, I put like a little extra level of like, I don't want to say like trans education 101, but just like a little bit more clarity. And I think with the TV show, we've kind of had to deal with that again. I genuinely think it's improved it. And, you know, it's just made all of everything a lot more nuanced and Barney a lot more three-dimensional. But it does, you do have to always consider that like someone might have stumbled on this without knowing. And so you have to, especially on a kids show, you have to hold their hand a little bit. But in terms of like growing up, I think I've changed as well. I've actually been watching Netflix's Babysitter's Club show recently, which I love. And I've never read the books, but I have a feeling that the parents and that are also being fleshed out a bit more. I know the books are all from the Babysitter Club members' like point of view, but the show has a few more scenes of the parents going through stuff. I think that does happen naturally. I don't know. I don't want parents to all feel like they're the bad guys.
Sure. That's fair. That they have a perspective as well. And, you know, this actually reminds me of another thing I've been looking at recently is there's this documentary Kiki that's about like the ballroom and Kiki scene in New York. It's from 2016. And interesting. It's sort of a follow-up to Paris is Burning, unofficial follow-up to Paris is Burning. And something that I observed about it is that there's a lot of chosen family, and that's great, and, you know, the thing that we always see about, like, going to the big city and finding your people. But there's also just a lot of biological family that's involved in these trans and gender nonconforming and non-binary people's lives. And it's just really interesting to me, like, what role chosen family takes when you also have just, you know, when your mom is cool.
Yeah. Something we have struggled with a little bit is the balance between representing a kind of hard truth and represent it, and then representing a kind of ideal world. We don't want the show to be filled with transphobia and homophobia. We don't want to, like, show on screen, you know, dead naming and misgendering and all that stuff. Like, we don't want that to be part of the show. And at the same time, we want Barney to have gone through something that's truthful to the book and truthful to, you know, the origins of the character. We've been very careful about what exactly the problem he has at home is. I don't actually know legally just what I should say or anything about just the plot lines and everything, but we've tried to make a specific grievance. And actually, I find a more interesting storyline about how even, like, supportive parents can fail, and how parents can think they're being well-meaning or, like, say, we support you so many times and then fail with their actions without maybe even knowing it. And so that's kind of the plot line we're going through. Also, like I said, this is Barney's story and it's, like, part of his character to be impulsive. And so he doesn't run away because everyone in that situation would run away. He runs away because he's Barney and that's kind of what he would do. So it's interesting. I mean, the other thing about making a TV show and getting a wider audience is just having to accept that you're not going to please everyone. Some people will hate it. I have a very thick skin. I love talking to people who don't like my stuff. I love talking to people who have... I was actually on a podcast once about webcomics. And again, I don't want to talk about... I have no feeling of ill will towards this person, but we were talking about queer representation of webcomics and someone said, oh, I started reading this webcomic about trans character and it was really good at the start. And then, like, all this stuff happened and I really hated this one plot line and it came all about, like, being trans. And I was like, oh, you're talking about my webcomic. And I was like, on this panel podcast with them. And they were mortified and they backtracked and stuff. And I was like, no. I really want to engage with you. I really want to try and do better. I know I can't please everyone. But I'm never gonna defend myself to the point of, like, disagreeing with someone's, like, emotional response to a piece of work. I can explain myself, I can explain my thoughts and feelings, but I know that I can make another story and try again and do better. Like, I mean, there has been cartoon shows with animated with trans characters before. By the time this comes out, I don't know how many others there have been, but there's a chance this might be, like, the most prominent main character of a show who's trans. And I know that that means there's responsibility, but there's also just has to be an acceptance that this won't be for everyone. And when things, I have no idea if this is going to be a big show or not, but sometimes the conversation around something changes based on its popularity. I've been thinking recently a little bit about Hamilton and the sort of controversies around it and valid criticisms, but they're criticisms that would be different had this been a small off-Broadway show and not the biggest musical ever. The conversations take on a slightly different sort of passion, I think, when you're trying to sort of criticize something that's the biggest thing in the world. If Deadlandia comes out on Netflix and no one really watches it and it gets cancelled straight away, I think the conversations around how well we did the representation will be slightly different than if it's being lauded and getting every award in the world and, you know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's going to be that microscope.
Yeah. So I just hope it helps some people. I also think, not to be like, yes, he's trans, but that's not the only thing about him. But, like, truly, the show is about demons and ghosts. And it's like what I was talking about Captain Jack in Doctor Who at the start. This is not a cartoon about being trans. It's not the trans cartoon. It's not the queer cartoon or anything like that. It is a show about monsters and ghosts and adventure. It's just one that takes place in the real world and one that says that these kinds of adventures could happen to anyone. And sometimes anyone's aren't just the same straight boy that you see in every cartoon.
So if people want to check out the book or the webcomic or stay connected to what's going on with the show, where should they go?
Dead Endia, the book, there's two volumes, Dead Endia, The Watcher's Test, and Dead Endia, The Broken Halo. They should be available at all bookshops. I would recommend going to your, you know, local comic book stores or local things or ordering. I'm sure every comic shop at the moment in the pandemic has like got its own options and things. Mm-hmm. They can also be ordered directly from the Nobrow website, which is the publisher. And of course, Amazon and places, but, you know, listen to what I said at the start. And
yeah, support your local store.
The show doesn't come out till later next year. And I think that's kind of everything. I'm at Hamish Steele on everything.
Awesome. Well, I cannot wait to see this show.
Thank you. Everyone should watch it when it comes out on as many devices as possible. Opening night.
Sounds like a plan. Will do. Hamish, thank you again so much for spending time with me.
No problem.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to Hamish for joining me. For this week's recommendation, I'd advise you check out his Kickstarter for Croc and Roll, which looks absolutely phenomenal, a big gay crocodile-themed story about being in a rock band. You can also jump over to YouTube to watch his cartoon, Dead End, that's loosely inspired by the same work as his upcoming Netflix series. It's a delightful, silly adventure with a ghost, a haunted Wi-Fi router, and an extremely muscular cat that I think you will find absolutely wonderful. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone who makes The Sewers of Paris possible on Patreon. Patreon backers get rewards like stickers and postcards in the mail, a copy of my book Defining Marriage, and also exclusive access to the Patreon-only podcast Cozy Pants, in which I chat with my partner James about the entertainment that's bringing us joy right now. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to support The Sewers of Paris and get access to those benefits. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com and join us for the next live stream on August 1st at 11 a.m. Pacific. There's a link pinned to the top of the Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. Check out my YouTube series Culture Cruise for detailed explorations of queer milestones from TV and film. And subscribe to my other shows Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends, two comedy adventure shows featuring drag queens playing Dungeons & Dragons. The theme song for The Sewers of Paris is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.